morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 24th of June. Craig Gilbert is our guest this hour. It's All Things Political, which you hear always Mondays at 9 o'clock. Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. There's a lot going on this week. The Supreme Court is announcing major decisions. Some of them may come today. We'll talk about those. The president will be talking about climate change tomorrow. Craig wrote a really interesting piece, and we wanted to start the conversation talking about what he wrote last week. And it concerns Wisconsin and Minnesota. They vote similar, but the policies diverge. He has an article that says that they may be as similar as any two states in America, but one is being governed like South Carolina and the other Vermont. How did that happen? What does it tell us about the way politics works today? He says small differences in election outcomes are amplified by very different redistricting plans that have led to total Democratic control in one state and total Republican control in the other. How did each state arrive at one-party power? We'll talk about that. And we'll welcome your phone calls as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, should you want to leave messages there. And in case you missed the article last week, we will post that on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Craig Gilbert, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
It's a busy week, but I want to start with that fascinating article you wrote last week, Mirror Opposites, Wisconsin, Minnesota, vote similar, but the policies diverge. Do they ever? And what's interesting is that they're very similar states, as you cite in the article.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we share a border. We share a lot of our ancestral heritage. So there are, you know, there's a big overlap, I would say, in the political culture. I mean, they're not identical. No two states are. But if you look, for example, at how they vote in presidential elections, which is a pretty good measure over time of kind of the partisan makeup of a state, they track very closely. In fact, just about as closely as any two states. They gave President Obama virtually identical majorities in 2012. So, you know, while they're not identical, there's nothing in the kind of underlying makeup and the voting, the general voting, historic voting behavior of the two states that would explain the kind of gap between how they're governing right now at the state level.
You go into great detail here, and you say if you switched about, this is just a minuscule number of votes, 4,600 votes across three state Senate races in Wisconsin in 2010, whole different outcome, 5,000 votes in Minnesota in 2010, there would have been a Republican governor to go with the Republican legislature. That's incredible.
Yeah, and in a political world where the difference between the two parties is so big, it means that tiny margins and tiny election shifts can have these sort of profound policy consequences, as we saw, for example, in the 2000 presidential election, where it was infinitesimal. I mean, the margin between Florida and one state between two parties, and then you look at all the consequences that flow from that. And so this is, you know, it's always, you know, it's just, I think it's history. I mean, that's history often turns on tiny events and small margins, but in politics, those tiny events and small margins loom really large where you have two parties that have grown further and further apart. And in this case, you know, there's not a lot, you know, if you switch around a few events and, you know, it could have been Minnesota that had total Republican control, and Wisconsin could have had a mixed bag, mm-hmm. In terms of the legislature. And if you didn't have total Republican control in Wisconsin, things would look a lot different today.
So what was the redistricting plan, Craig, in Minnesota, and what was the plan in Wisconsin?
Well, here's where what happened in 2010 was so important because, as we said, in Wisconsin, it gave Republicans complete control, unified control in a going into a legislative year in which the new districts would be drawn for Congress and for the state legislature, whereas in Minnesota, even though Republicans took over the state legislature, there was a three-way race for governor in which Democrats won by a tiny margin, tiny, tiny margin. So that resulted in divided government in Minnesota. When you have divided government, as we've seen in the past in Wisconsin, generally what happens is the parties disagree vehemently over redistricting, and a court sort of steps in and approves a plan. And that happened in Minnesota, and usually those plans are fairly neutral in partisan terms. So they don't do anything really sweeping to shift power in one direction or the other, and that's, again, what happened in Minnesota. But in Wisconsin, Republicans had total control, so they wrote a very, very aggressive map that really stacked the deck in favor of Republicans and against Democrats. And the effect of that was seen in the 2012 elections, where the map was in effect. And basically, I guess one way of putting it is that if you think about the fact that President Obama won statewide in Wisconsin by 7 points, yet Mitt Romney easily carried the majority of legislative districts. So that tells you that Republican voters were very efficiently distributed so that they represented a majority in a majority of the legislative districts in the state, even in a year in which they were doing pretty poorly in the statewide election.
Let's talk about the ramifications of this. The partisan gap, you write in their job ratings, according to the public policy polling firm, is bigger than in any of the, I think, 34-plus states where the firm has polled in the past few years. They're enormous.
Yeah, now and I've written about this in the past, and Scott Walker has kind of stood out among the nation's governors, not in terms of his overall approval rating, which is, you know, around 50-51% typically, but in terms of the gap between how he's perceived in his own party by voters and how he's perceived by voters in the other party. You obviously, every governor is, almost every governor, not quite, but almost every governor is going to be seen more favorably by voters in their own party. But you find an extreme example of that in Governor Walker, where, you know, his approval ratings among Republican voters are in the 90s, and his approval ratings among Democratic voters are in single digits. And it turns out that Mark Dayton, the Democratic governor of Minnesota, is been sort of running number two in that department in terms of those sort of the size of those partisan splits. Now, it probably tells you something about the state and tells you something about the individual. I mean, it tells you something in about each of these governors and the way they've been governing, and it probably also tells you something about how polarized these two states are.
Mm-hmm. And what does it mean for 2014?
Well, it means that we're going to have this sort of fascinating dynamic where you have governors of different parties governing with the help of legislative majorities in their own parties and passing very ambitious agendas and running simultaneously for re-election in these two states that are not all that different. And so you're going to have, I mean, when you think about what the legislature's been doing this year in both states and what Wisconsin's been doing the last couple of years, you just go down the line and you know, they've been going in opposite directions on taxes, on health care, on social issues. Minnesota's legalizing same-sex marriage, and on a different social issue, Wisconsin's requiring, you know, ultrasound tests for women seeking abortions. Unions. I mean, unions has been a huge issue, obviously, yes, in Wisconsin. And while Wisconsin's been kind of really, really, really weakening public sector unions, Minnesota actually voted in this current session to allow a whole new class of workers to unionize. So again, go down the line of issues, and these two states have been just moving in opposite directions.
So are these governing philosophies anomalies? Minnesota is normally more, what, middle of the road, not as progressive as what it is now. Wisconsin is usually not as conservative as what it is now?
Well, yes and no. I mean, certainly obviously, the fact that we don't have divided government in these two states is one big factor here, because if you go back in the past, there have been lots, in fact, it's probably been true more often than not, you've had divided government, so the parties have been forced to work with each other, and that's led to kind of more moderate policies. But I think most political scientists would also say that when you look at the two parties today, there's less sort of ideological diversity within those parties when you look at their politicians and elected officials. So just to take one example, you know, you don't have to go back too many years to find that you had, on the issue of abortion, you had some Democrats who were, quote, pro-life, and some Republicans who were, quote, pro-choice. Both in Congress and at the state level today, that's virtually disappeared. So on a whole bunch of issues, the two parties have kind of sorted themselves out ideologically where there's very little overlap between them. So yeah, instead of in the old days where you might have had a big moderate wing in one of these parties that had unified control kind of acting as a brake on the policies, that's less of a factor today.
So what do people in Wisconsin think about all of that? What do people in Minnesota think about all of that? We've heard that people would prefer to have a kind of center government that were more center, be as a Democratic or Republican.
Well, I guess we'll find out in 2014 to some degree. I mean, at least in the terms of the gubernatorial election, no election is a perfect test of all these things. And when you have the when you have the map you have in Wisconsin, of course, it's not going to be a very good test at all because the landscape is so tilted toward one party that, as we saw in the 2012 election, where it was actually a better year for Democrats than it was for Republicans, it didn't really matter. It didn't really affect Republican majorities in the legislature because the districts are just so favorable to them. But I think the campaigns for governor will be an interesting test of that. I mean, it's not always the case that voters prefer moderate policies, but it is sometimes the case that parties overreach. And you know, I would not necessarily try to argue that what Minnesota is doing and what Wisconsin is doing, that there's some sort of equivalence between them, because I don't know. I didn't have the time or the scope in the story to sort of go down issue by issue and see which of these policies is sort of, you know, polls better in each of these states. But it may come to that. I mean, we may be able to track that going forward. I mean, what the Minnesota legislature did is so new. I mean, the Democrats just got control, and this legislative session just happened in May, and so it's probably a little too soon to tell how that's playing in Minnesota, whereas in Wisconsin we have a little bit more of a track record.
And tell me, Craig, how this redistricting works. How often is it done? How long does it stay in place?
It's done traditionally after every 10 years after the decennial census. And so one of the kind of oddball wild cards in politics has always been what happens in the elections that end with zero, because that means that whoever wins those elections at the state level has a chance to kind of extend their power in time by changing the political map in a way that has consequences for many future election cycles. So it's kind of like the gift that keeps on giving. If you're a party that takes control in a year that ends, you know, in a year that ends in a 10 or a 20 or a 30 or 40 or whatever, you can kind of lock in your majorities for a little while. And then, you know, population change kicks in, and eventually those advantages may dissipate, and then you have a new redistricting year. But it had been a long time in Wisconsin since one party had total control in a redistricting year. And so this is the most, you know, kind of aggressive map in partisan terms that we've seen in a long time.
Mm-hmm. And is this true in other states in the country that have one-party control?
Yeah, and it has been true. For example, it's not just Republicans. I mean, there have been some states, some Democratic states. I would say the majority of states, I think, I don't know what the percentage is, but it may be that more than half the states had divided control after 2010. I'm not quite sure, but some states, obviously, you had divided control, so you had some states actually have a system where it's not purely partisan. Iowa, where there's a commission, and that so they just tend to generate fairly competitive, you know, neutral maps every time. But there were states in both controlled by both parties that drafted very aggressive, very partisan maps that were that really kind of stuck it to the other party. And you know, the interesting thing from a legal point of view, and we had the Wisconsin case went before the courts, and what was interesting about that decision, that federal decision, is it was obvious that the federal judges were very disapproving of the map, and particularly of the process by which the map was drawn in this case. But they also said, you know, look, the law doesn't necessarily give us a legal foundation for just rejecting a map because it's too partisan. There have to be other problems with the map. for example, whether it is unfair to in terms of its impact on the voting power of minorities. So it's not just enough in legal terms to say, wow, this is a really partisan map, and it doesn't really necessarily reflect the overall makeup of the state. I mean, you have to find something else wrong with the map. And so they ended up approving, by and large, I mean, the overwhelming majority of districts in this map for that reason.
And what about disapproving of the way the whole thing is set up? If indeed a commission does things a little bit less partisanly, why don't we all states use commissions?
Well, because in most cases, elected officials are against that idea, because it takes, it removes the power that they enjoy today. So, this is something that state legislatures, in most states are empowered to do, and they don't want to give up that ability to do it.
Craig Gilbert, our guest. It's All Things Political for this Monday, the 24th of June, and we're welcoming your phone calls. I found this very interesting. And when you look at the two states, it is remarkable how completely different they are, even though we share a lot of the same traditions. We both vote in very large numbers, I think among the highest in the country. We'll ask Craig that. So we'll welcome your thoughts on what's going on in Wisconsin and what's going on in Minnesota. Also, there will be a lot of other big news. Perhaps the Supreme Court will hand down major decisions today, perhaps later in the week. President is talking about climate change. We can discuss that and all that will be discussed in Washington this upcoming week. Here's our phone number. Join us, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to use that, we would like to read comments. There is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls for Craig Gilbert. The Supreme Court has ruled on Fisher versus the University of Texas. We're just getting beginning information here. That's the affirmative action case. They will send it back to a lower court. More information as the hour goes along. Nothing yet on DOMA or Proposition 8 or on voting. So that's where that stands. Let's go to phone calls for Craig. We start with Janet in Amory. Hi, Janet.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm talking, we're a resident of Wisconsin, have lived in Minnesota for many, many years. And, of course, in western Minnesota, we don't get a lot of Wisconsin news. But I'm wondering about the influence of the business community in Minnesota. On the recent vote on the amendment, on the marriage amendment, which was defeated, several Fortune 500 companies came out and asked people to vote no, as it would affect their ability to recruit people to work from all over the country. I'm wondering if you can comment on if there is a difference in the business climate in Wisconsin and Minnesota, or if not. Thank you.
Thanks, Janet.
Well, there's a couple of interesting aspects to that question. I mean, I think it's true that if you look at the Twin Cities and sort of their corporate infrastructure, it's a little bit different from Milwaukee. Obviously, the Twin Cities are bigger, and so that dynamic of having big corporations that are worried about their ability to recruit people from other parts of the country is probably a more significant factor in a place like Minnesota than in Wisconsin, because of the nature of the Twin Cities and its economic makeup and its kind of corporate profile. In terms of the overall economy of the two states, you know, Minnesota has really been doing better than Wisconsin. And I think you have to be a little bit careful about how you, you know, what you read into that in terms of how the two states are being governed right now. Because while Republicans have been governing and, you know, pursuing sort of one policy track in Wisconsin ever since the 2010 elections, in Minnesota, the Democratic direction of the state is a recent phenomenon. I mean, it just basically happened in the wake of the 2012 election. So it's probably too soon in Minnesota to sort of start talking about the impact of this latest batch of Democratic policies on the state's economy. But it's a fair discussion to have in Wisconsin about, you know, to what degree, what's the influence and what's the effects of policies under Governor Walker on the state's economy. And that debate has been unfolding in Wisconsin because of the state's poor performance in the last few years relative to other states in terms of private sector job growth. You have a pretty vigorous debate going on between the two parties over whose fault is that and whether it's a byproduct of the governor's policies or whether it's a byproduct of a whole bunch of other factors.
Thanks, Janet, for the call. Jerry in Onalaska. Hi, Jerry.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
I wish you'd please discuss a little more the premise you have that our states are really very similar, and I just sort of question that. Well, number one, Wisconsin is our big city is Milwaukee, which is in the shadow of Chicago. I think that makes a big difference. I think our history in Wisconsin is more related to the auto industry. I mean, they got used to have American Motors. We've got Keycoffer, the Marine. We've got a lot of greasy, grindy kind of work. Minnesota has been more grain oriented, as I remember their history. I think the Wisconsin is more Germanic, and while Minnesota is more
Norwegian,
Nordic.
Mm-hmm.
Let me also discuss some of the other things. I think there are differences.
Okay.
Oh, there certainly are differences, and you've listed a whole bunch of them. I mean, they're actually both pretty Germanic. It's just Minnesota has a bigger sort of Scandinavian ancestry than Wisconsin does, but it's all relative. I mean, there's lots of differences between these two states, but if you look at, and as there are between any two states, but when you look at, for example, take each state and look at their degree of similarity or difference with all the other 49 states, and if you line them all up, I mean, you probably find that, what state is Minnesota closest to in many of these, in terms of its voting behavior, in terms of, we talked about turnout, they're 1 and 2 in turnout every year. I mean, that tells you something about their political culture, the level of engagement and participation. And again, the best single sort of indicator of voting behavior that's common to all the states is how they vote for president. And there's very little difference. I mean, between these two states, if you average out the last four presidential elections, there's a fraction of a point difference in terms of how the Democratic vote for president in that time. So, yeah, there's lots of differences. There's differences between the cities. There's differences in their sort of geography. There's differences, like I said, in their history and everything else. But compared to differences with other states, they're relatively small, and they're not, the differences we're talking about aren't anywhere near dramatic enough, I think, to sort of explain why two states would go off in such different policy directions. Because, again, we're not talking about the difference between Minnesota and South Carolina or, Wisconsin and California. We're talking about the difference between two upper Midwestern states that do have a lot of overlap and do share a lot of things and do vote often in very similar ways.
It's kind of something to be proud of that we're number 1 and 2 when it comes to voting, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think it's something that both states should be very proud of. That what's interesting to me is what's the relationship between that intense engagement and participation and political division and polarization in these states, because mm-hmm. we've seen that by some measures these states are also pretty polarized and pretty divided. And so do those two things kind of feed off each other is an interesting question to me. But if you look at presidential voting and the last 3 or 4 presidential elections, every time Minnesota's number 1 in terms of the percentage of its eligible voters that turn out to vote, and Wisconsin's number 2.
Mm-hmm. Both states also have this, at times in history it's been fairly strong, this progressive wing, this kind of Hubert Humphrey, mm-hmm. Paul Wellstone wing of the Minnesota Democrats and Bob La Follette in Wisconsin. Are any of those philosophies still strong? Do they manifest themselves in Democratic politics in either state now?
It's hard to say because of the passage of time. I think you can find some legacies, but I remember spending a lot of time on that question years ago, and you know, trying to sort of separate the mythology from the actuality. And I think, you know, you can talk about, for example, in Wisconsin, you can talk about the Scandinavian and Germanic influence and the sort of progressive traditions. And you can find, you can make the case that it has a legacy. It certainly, you know, we're a state, for example, I believe this is also true in Minnesota, no death penalty. You know, and if you look at the states that don't have a death penalty, they tend to be a little bit clustered geographically. You know, obviously Wisconsin is a state that's had traditionally a pretty, you know, fairly high taxes and a fairly progressive tax system. And I think you can argue that that's sort of a legacy of its political history in many ways. And so you can sort of identify some things, this culture of engagement we've been talking about, that are that may be tied to that, that to that heritage. But, you know, obviously a lot of time has passed since the people that kind of created that heritage first came over here.
Craig Gilbert is our guest. All Things Political is what you're listening to here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And let's go next to Claire in Germantown. Hi, Claire.
Oh, hi. Yes, my grandpa ran on the socialist ticket for mayor of Milwaukee in 1924.
Really?
The year I was born. But
Who is that, Claire?
Dr. Ralph Elmer Green.
Uh-huh.
E-L-M-E-R-G-R-E-E-N. Mm-hmm. He was a socialist, but not quite as... I go to Florida, Floridians against Common Core.com. I mean, this socialist president we got is far, far further to the left than my grandpa. My grandpa only wanted the government to pay for the heat and the light.
You think the President Obama is a socialist?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And he's way, way far to the left of my grandpa.
Craig?
Well, leaving aside President Obama, I mean, it is true that there is this sort of interesting socialist tradition in Wisconsin and in Milwaukee. Milwaukee's the last city of its size to actually have a socialist mayor. And it's also true that there was a, you know, brand of socialism, some people called it sewer socialism, that was really not the kind of socialism we think about in terms of kind of modern big state socialism, but was sort of about more mundane things like public services, and these parties ran against corruption. They ran on delivering services. They ran on having a sort of an effective and somewhat activist government. But so there is that. That is part of this state's political tradition that sets it apart from some other states. Is, you know, just like we had the sort of Progressive Party as an offshoot of the Republican Party, we have a pretty interesting a party history if you go back far enough in time, that, you know, there was an era in Wisconsin's history when four different parties were winning elections for major office at the same time. So that's kind of an interesting artifact of our history for sure.
Yeah. I know that President Obama has been labeled a socialist by some, those who are not very happy with him. I think he'd be hard-pressed to say that his political philosophy is socialism.
Yeah, and everybody means something else when they use that term. I mean, you've got social democratic parties in Europe that refer to themselves as socialists that are really, that are a far cry from, again, what some other people mean by socialism. So that's the problem with that discussion, is that word has come to mean so many different things to so many different people.
Thanks, Claire, for the call. Jim in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. It seems to me that there's a substantial difference between people at the leadership level of the Democratic Party and the regular mom-and-pop people, Democrats. And, yes, the Republicans and Democrats differ on social issues, but on foreign policy and how the government is actually regulated, it seems to me that the right-center wing of the Democratic Party, the Obama and Clinton wing, are basically in cahoots. And, you know, it's ironic, coming up on the 4th of July, we honor the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And if I had my way, I'd put up a statue right next to the Washington Monument. But I wouldn't honor people like Jefferson or Robert Morris, who framed the Constitution. But no, I'd put up a tall statue honoring a real hero, Philip Morris. And why Philip Morris? Because Philip Morris is a perfect example of what we've come to in America, which I would call capitalism. The product is useless, overpriced, dangerous to the user and to people around the user, and for a long time underregulated. And it's a perfect way to symbolize the win-at-all-costs world that we have, quotes, grown into. Yay, freedom.
All right. Thank you, Jim, for your call and comments this morning. Let's go to Kathleen in Madison. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, I'm just wondering if the guest can talk about the differences in approaches to crime and punishment in Wisconsin and Minnesota. It's my understanding that Minnesota has a much lower prison population, and obviously that's an ongoing issue, especially considering the budgetary issues that everyone's facing. I'll just take the comments off the air.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and I'm not an expert in this area, but it is my sense also that we have a higher incarceration rate in Wisconsin than in Minnesota. I've heard that. I know that my paper has written about this to some degree. I certainly don't know a lot about what the situation is in Minnesota, but that may be an interesting contrast between the two states and something that would kind of bears looking at.
And we will do that. We've done that occasionally on this show, but we'll do it again sometime. Carol in Muscadet. Hi.
Hi. I grew up in Minnesota, and I live in Wisconsin, and I have now for 10 years. I also would visit Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin, as a child. The differences to me are enormous. Culturally, the overwhelming thing for me is the difference in a degree of cosmopolitanism. Minnesota feels like it's open to the world. It feels more like Europe or Canada to me, where I also lived. It isn't equal to those places, but it is more like those places than Wisconsin. I think part of that is a function of the fact that people in Wisconsin do not go outside of Wisconsin. People in Minnesota do. They travel, and people come from all over the world there all the time for conferences and events, and there's just a lot of activity internationally going on that I don't see in Wisconsin to the same degree or the same quality. So I think that makes an enormous difference in reference to the business climate and to the intellectual imagination of the people themselves and the quality of their schools. It's a huge difference for me.
All right, thanks, Carol. Craig?
Yeah, and again, just a couple of points. I mean, I would never argue that the two states are identical, but I do think, you know, you have to. I try to sort of stick to stuff that I can measure, and everybody's certainly entitled to their kind of perceptions of the similarities and differences in a case like this, and it's sort of hard to argue with perceptions. But if you look at stuff that you can actually measure, it's hard to say, again, particularly if we're talking about politics, the two states are dramatically different when you look at their voting behavior in national elections, as we've discussed. Certainly, I think one of the more interesting differences between the two states sort of involves sort of, you know, comparing the Twin Cities to Milwaukee in Wisconsin. You've got, you know, the state's university and state capital and its sort of population center and economic hub in two different cities, in Madison and Milwaukee, unlike Minnesota, where they're combined into one city. And that certainly creates differences and creates a different dynamic. But again, if you go to things that you can actually measure, I'm not sure that you find such profound differences in a lot of these, you know, across a lot of these measures as the caller is talking about. And again, you know, the point in the end is whatever the differences are between the two states, they don't, you know, politically speaking, they wouldn't, you wouldn't expect them to result in two states sort of governing in such antithetical ways, the way you might expect, you know, two states in opposite corners of the country or with, you know, completely different, you know, demographics to do. So I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. And speaking up a little bit for Wisconsin, we're not, you know, all that backwoods, I don't think. Minnesota, if you go outside Minneapolis, is a fairly rural kind of place. There isn't a whole lot going on.
That's why I said it's sort of, it's very, you know, when we're talking about sort of perceptions between the states, it's a fun conversation to have.
Yes.
But is it, you know, can you actually sort of support some of those statements with very much rigor? I'm not so sure.
Well, the real question, Craig, is who's nicer? You got Minnesota nice. Do you have Wisconsin nice, too?
I think we have Wisconsin friendly and fun-loving, for sure.
I think so, too. More phone calls in a moment. It's all things political, although we were branching into other areas there for a little while. We have yet to get to, because this article that Craig wrote is absolutely fascinating, and it will be on our Facebook page in case you didn't see it. It was last week, but this was the week we could get Craig on the air, and it looks at why these two states are so completely different when it comes to all of the policies that have been enacted, one Democratic state, one Republican state, and yet the makeup of the populations are not all that different. We vote in the largest numbers of any states in the country. Why are things so different? But there are other things going on, too, and we will move into some of those. The president is going to give a speech on climate change. A lot of people saying he hasn't said much about it, and nobody's doing much about it. We'll talk about that. Supreme Court decisions. The Supreme Court did rule on Fisher versus the University of Texas, the affirmative action case, sending it back to a lower court, and we'll get more information about that. There is nothing on Defense of Marriage Act or Proposition 8 yet or voting, so those will be coming up perhaps later this week or later today. Here's how you reach our conversation. Join us at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, our email talk at WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, we will be talking about our pay. Carrie Spivak, it's a real Milwaukee Journal Sentinel day for us today, wrote a piece on the state's 10 best paid executives, and it showed that the chief executive officers running Wisconsin public companies scored an average pay increase of 31% last year, bringing their average compensation up to, this is hard to imagine, $10.5 million. Pay for the typical worker in the state increased 2.37%. I think the average average worker in the state makes about $41,000 a year. Also, we'll look at this. I'm not sure if we'll have a guest from this, but Deadspin published a map of the highest paid public employee in each state. And I don't know if you'll be surprised by this or not. You can guess who that might be, and we will talk about it. Hour two of our show. Craig Gilbert is here now, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Clyde in Cedarburg. Hi.
Hi. the solution to, or a solution, a useful solution to the strange disparity of the politics that are representing Minnesota and Wisconsin, in spite of the apparent similarity of the peoples, is that to have elections that are actually, in which actual elections actually represent the will of the people and not the will of the parties. We don't need redistricting. The parties need redistricting. We don't need districts. We could have at-large preference elections in which we would have much better representation of the people. That's done in other parts of the world. It's not allowed by our current state law. And regarding comparing Minnesota, a different subject, if I can mention another
sure.
point. There are two, comparing Minnesota and Wisconsin, there is a real similarity in the two states that's of interest that was brought out by a study that was done by Bread for the World, which is a faith-based organization which is concerned with poverty around the world and in the United States. And their survey, I was interested to note that in their survey, there were 9 states in the United States that possess an African-American child poverty rate that is more than double the overall rate of child poverty in that state. So we're talking about disparity in child poverty based on race. There are 9 states that possess, that are the worst, that have an African-American child poverty rate that is more than double the overall rate. Not a single Deep South state is among those. And the top three, the worst three, are in order Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. So those three states, Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, rank the worst in the nation in terms of relative disparity of child poverty, comparing African-American child poverty with the overall rate of child poverty in that state.
Craig.
Yeah, and that's a long-standing phenomenon that again, I think I have some colleagues who have been looking at that, who've written about it or writing about it in the future, and so I'm not an expert on why that is the case, but it's been true for some time, at least in Wisconsin's case, that when you talk about measures of gaps between black and white economic measures, Wisconsin typically, or Milwaukee typically, ranks as having a fairly extreme gap, and that's not a new thing. And it may tell you some combination of things. Obviously, it's an indicator of the economics of people in the minority community. It may also, be the combination of that and, pretty good economic conditions in the majority community, which, again, is not something that's true of all states either. So it's not a new thing. And the fact that it's those three states suggests it has something to do with, a common history in terms of the minority communities in those states and when, sort of, the migration, when that migration occurred and what the economics and underpinning was of African Americans in those states and in those cities in those states and how those communities, what's happened to those communities over time.
Thank you very much for the call, Clyde. Just moving briefly, although I'm fascinated by this Wisconsin-Minnesota story, and many are, and we'll take more calls on that. The Supreme Court is evidently done for today, so the affirmative action case, we'll send it back to a lower court. Other big cases, how many more days are left on this for there not, either tomorrow or Thursday? Or
yeah, what? I think it's just this week, so I think it's yes. I think the answer is yes.
Okay, and do you have any thoughts about why they have held off on some of these?
That's pretty common. I mean, that often happens. There's a sort of countdown on these high-profile cases, and sometimes they get left to the very end.
Okay. And the president is speaking tomorrow. He's decided to speak on climate change.
Well, it's interesting he's doing that, and I don't know exactly what he's going to say, but, it's a big issue. I'm not sure where to begin with climate change.
Right. Well, maybe somebody should start talking about it. It's interesting that he's chosen now to talk about it. Immigration reform. What the heck is going on with that? Is it more problematic for the Republicans now to decide what they want to do?
Yeah, I mean, Republicans are torn, and obviously there's a lot of differences. The internal differences on immigration are much bigger within the Republican Party right now than they are within the Democratic Party. And so you've got these different dynamics on the Republican side where you have genuine substantive differences. There are some Republicans who think that who support the idea of an earned path to citizenship for people that came here illegally, as long as the rest of the bill kind of is up to snuff from their point of view on border security and other things. There are other Republicans who are dead set against that idea and think that basically no matter how you, no matter what conditions you attach and tests you attach and criteria you attach to the path to citizenship, that it still amounts to amnesty. And so you've got that divide. And then on top of that, you've got a sense among the leadership of the party, certainly among much of the leadership of the party has a political problem, and that until until there's something is done about immigration reform, Republicans will be seen as the obstacle, and they'll be seen as not open to Latino voters, and they'll be punished by Latino voters, a growing part of the electorate. So, you know, in the aftermath of the 2012 election, when that seemed to be, one explanation for Mitt Romney's defeat, was his poor performance among Hispanic voters. There's new energy in the Republican Party to try to work with Democrats to get a so-called comprehensive bill done that includes a path to citizenship. But that's not necessarily where all the Republican voters are. And again, there's division among Republican voters on this too. So all those things are making for a very interesting debate. And then you've got the differences between the two chambers and Republicans in the House and Republicans in the Senate. So it's hard to legislate on anything these days, for all these reasons. But this in some ways there's more hope. If you think it's a good idea, there's more hope for bipartisan action on immigration because of the politics of immigration than on a lot of other issues, but it's by no means a certainty.
Jack Craver from the Capital Times emailed to say, I wrote an article recently comparing the dramatically different political turns that the states have taken in recent years. The biggest response I got was not to the political points I made, but to the opening sentence in which I noted the similarity between the two states. Lakes, Germans, moderate. They are not similar, responded a disgruntled reader who proceeded to list off a series of differences between the two states, including the percentage of population of Norwegian descent and the size of their largest cities. I asked the reader and many others on Twitter to name two states that are more similar. Overwhelmingly, people responded, North and South Dakota.
Yeah, it's probably hard to top North and South Dakota, but,
right.
but maybe there are hidden differences there. I know there's economic differences, and there's certainly natural resource differences that could have an impact on there. But when you have two states that are that homogeneous to begin with, it's probably. But you know, again, even those states, if you look at their presidential voting behavior, I think you might see a bigger gap. I mean, certainly on culture and demographics, they may be more similar. But if you just took this one measure of how they vote in presidential elections, I'm not sure that the gap might even be bigger between those two states than it is between Wisconsin and Minnesota. So you have to be careful about those judgments.
Yeah. Rich in Rhinelander. Hi.
Hi. While we're doing the counting, the House of Representatives, Minnesota and Wisconsin each have 8 in the House. In Wisconsin, it's 5 Republicans and 3 Democrats. In Minnesota, it's exactly the opposite.
My.
It's 5 Democrats and 3 Republicans.
The
rightward drift of politics in Wisconsin is a tragedy. It really is.
Well, that difference in the composition of the House is, in some cases, just sort of cyclical and episodic. I mean, you can go back over the last 20 or 30 years and find that number shifting back and forth. It's also, redistricting comes into play here, too, because you have 5 of the 8 districts are favorable to Republicans, because Democratic voters are so concentrated in the Madison and Milwaukee districts, that means there are fewer Democratic voters available to these other districts. So right now the map, and we saw with the new map, it wasn't a radical change, but you saw the old Dave Obey district in northern Wisconsin,
right,
which was truly kind of a 50-50 district, was made a more Republican district when they took out 3 small cities in central Wisconsin and connected them to the western Wisconsin district of Ron Kind, thereby making Sean Duffy's northern Wisconsin district safer for Republicans. So there are redistricting effects also, not just in the state legislature, but also at the congressional level.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Rich, very much. Craig, always a great pleasure. Keep writing those very interesting articles.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Craig Gilbert, our guest. He joins us frequently for All Things Political. And speaking of All Things Political, there will be more about this at 10:58. But All Things Political has been at this time for 8 years now on the Ideas Network. And starting next Monday, July 1st, our show will be moving to a new time, 1 to 3 in the afternoon. All Things Political will still be a regularly scheduled show, but it's going to be at 1 o'clock on Mondays. The show will be the same, just the time will be different. I really do believe, and you should know that guests say this about you all the time, that you, the listeners, are the heart of this program. I love hearing from you, taking your intelligent and interesting calls, and they will be a part of our program. So we please invite you to come along with us. Make the change starting next week, 1 to 3. I say this now because Talk of the Nation is going off the air that day, and we want those of you who love these political conversations, we will be there next Monday, July 1st at 1 o'clock. We'll tell you more about this at 10:58 this morning. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to you for all of your intelligent and informative comments. We'll be back. News is coming up.